What is up, freaks? It's your boy Marty Bent here, sitting in a village by the sea to introduce this week's episode of Tales from the Crypt with Fabian Yar, an incredible young man who has been participating in the Chain Code Labs summer residency. We had a great conversation about his experience in Bitcoin, the German Bitcoin scene, Berlin in particular, his experience with Lightning and a bunch of other cool stuff, including what he's been working on this summer. This episode of Tales from the Crypt is brought to you by the Cash App. You freaks already know all about them. They're our favorite P2P payments app, because they're allowing us to stack sats, right? You can buy Bitcoin on the app. You can sell Bitcoin on the app. You can send Bitcoin from the app to a personal wallet or from a personal wallet to the app. They're really building out their Bitcoin functionalities. On top of that, they have an incredible boost program. This is one of my favorite things at the Cash App. You get a personalized debit card. It's accepted anywhere that Visa is, and then they partner with merchants that allow you to initiate Boost, and you're able to save a little bit of money when you go to those merchants using those Boost. These merchants include things like Whole Foods, Chick-fil-A, Taco Bell, your local coffee shop, and a bunch of other stuff. They're always adding Boost and adding functionalities to the app. So use the code if you haven't downloaded it yet. If you were late to the Cash App game and you were just downloading it now, make sure you use the code STACKINGSATS. That's one word. STACING. Excuse me. I just spelled that wrong. STACKINGSATS. One word. You're going to get $5. Then $5 is going to go to Owls Lacrosse out of Chicago, an incredible charity helping young boys and girls in the West and South Side of Chicago develop leadership skills via the sport of lacrosse. So go download the Cash App today, use the promo code STACKINGSATS, get that $5, feel good about yourself for sending $5 to Alves, and then enjoy this episode with Fabian. I know I did. Okay. Tales from the Crypt. What is up, freaks? Welcome back to Tales from the Crypt. It's your boy Marty Bent here on a Monday night, sitting down with another member of the Chain Code Bootcamp. Very excited for this. I saw this gentleman early in the summer when he first came to the States to embark on the Chain Code Bootcamp. We met after a BitDevs. I believe it was the first day that you guys were doing it, or the second.
It was the first one, yeah.
Yeah. I'd like to introduce you freaks to Fabian Yar. Fabian, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much.
How's your summer been since we first met?
Awesome. It's so great to be at Chain Code, and I'm learning a lot, meeting lots of great people, working with a lot of great people. It's awesome.
So before we dip into like the nitty gritty of your tale and stuff, I just think it's not hilarious. I think it's awesome because I'd done a boot camp before too, and I knew how invigorating that environment was. Like I did it was 12 weeks. A 12-week digital design boot camp wasn't quite as intense as the one you're going through, but it was an intense exposure to UX and UI design and front-end development, but you're like hanging out with a very small group of dedicated people for sometimes 12 hours a day, 6 days a week. What's the experience been like for you? Because I remember the first night you guys were in the city after Chain Code, after BitDevs, just like the vibes were high. It was like all the new residents or boot campers, whatever you want to call them, were meeting each other and spitballing ideas what you guys wanted to work on. So how's it been since that first night?
First of all, we had like this on-ramp phase that took like 2.5 weeks or so, where we had planned out schedule basically of presentations, lots of people coming in to visit us and talk about interesting topics. Some of the presenters were from Chain Code, but some of them also visiting, like Touch, for example, and Giulia Fanti and a couple of other people that I'm forgetting. We didn't really have much time to think about like what we were going to build or so, I think, in the first few days. So it was really just a fire hose of information. We were kind of dealing with that in the first few days. Of course, it was awesome meeting all these people and talking about ideas with them. And then afterwards, there was like, I would say like a transition week, which was 4th of July week, which meant there was not that much going on. Like we were also Some people, they actually went camping in the woods to take a break. I also explored the city a bit over that weekend. And since then, we're kind of free to explore our ideas. But of course, we get help with whatever we want to do. And there's really not any pressure for us to really deliver specifics or so, or directing us into something that we really want to do. But we get help with, like, to work on something that actually makes sense, that where there's a high chance that it's actually going to get merged at some point. And that's what we're working on now.
Yeah, so you decided to work on an RPC call that indexes the UTXO set, correct?
Yeah, exactly. So it's getTX outset info, which is a RPC call. I feel like it's not really getting much attention. And I think also the reason for that is that it takes several minutes. The thing that takes several minutes is that it calculates a hash of the whole UTXO set. That's just a pretty inefficient hash function that is running over the whole UTXO set, and does just takes a couple of minutes on mainnet, on testnet on my computer, takes like almost 2 minutes. It's for me not really surprising that it's not really getting used. So the main use case where I've seen it actually being used in the wild is FastSync from BTC Pay Server, where you can get like a UTXO set from Nicolas Dorier, basically. Then you can compare the hash of that UTXO set with somebody else's hash to make sure that you got the right UTXO set. But aside from that, it's not really getting used.
So you're sort of depending on that BTC Pay Server model for somebody else to run it as well and cross-check against that.
You depend on getting the UTXO set from them, because nobody else is probably going to give it to you in that package, basically. Mm-hmm. Then you basically have by hand to ask someone for the hash from their UTXO set. But it's also not exposed on the P2P layer, of course, because it would be a huge vulnerability of the DOS attack. Mm-hmm. What I'm working on now is something that was proposed 2 years ago by SIPA, Peter Willer, who proposed to use a rolling hash function that is updating with every block, and that you could basically get instantly a hash. The nice thing about such a rolling homomorphic hash function is you can just add hashes of new UTXOs on the fly as new blocks get accepted. You can also subtract them as blocks get rolled back. That's a much more efficient solution for that kind of problem.
The concept of rolling back hashes is something that, or if the chain rolls back, you can subtract that. All right, that makes sense then. Yeah, actually, not rolling back the hash. So how did you come to decide? It seems like it's a pretty blank slate that chain code throws at you. And like you said, they let you sort of figure out what you want to work on. And I know you said this is something you think should be fixed, but how exactly did you contemplate working on anything else and sort of thought, this is probably where my time best spent?
I should also say that when they interview you to get accepted to the program, they already ask you like what you want to work on, and they already know that probably you might not be working on exactly what you're presenting there, but it's kind of a requirement I think to get accepted to already have ideas and to kind of have see some things in Bitcoin or Lightning that you want to fix or improve. Basically, every one of us came in with some ideas, especially for me, they changed a lot. The 1 year or so before the residency, I had mostly been concerned with Lightning. There was just a big motivator for me to a new way of using Bitcoin, basically, that motivated me to build applications on top of it. I I basically wanted to work on Lightning stuff. But then we had the introductory phase that I talked about, where we were talking about lots of issues and things around Bitcoin in the first part of that time. And that kind of got me back to being very excited about working on Bitcoin. Just had several ideas that I also wanted to work on Bitcoin Core. While I'm still very excited about Lightning, I just decided in the end to work on an issue with Bitcoin Core.
So were you predominantly focused on Lightning, like your whole developing on Bitcoin career, quote unquote, if you're sitting at your career, but like the whole time you've been building on Bitcoin, has it been on the Lightning layer and this is your first exposure to Core, or were you sort of reviewing Core before you got fascinated with Lightning?
Yeah, but I would say that was not comparable. Like, I haven't really built a functional application or so at the scale of the stuff that I built on Lightning. Like, my understanding of Bitcoin was much lower back then, before 2016, 2017 or so. Like, I think I had a kind of good picture of how Bitcoin works, but it just was... Yeah, I was lacking ideas, basically, I would say, that motivated me to really build applications on top of it. Like, it seemed like lots of the ideas that I found compelling, there were already projects out there, and then I kind of didn't have the time, I guess, to really get into them and contribute. At least that's what it felt like. And then Lightning was kind of something new, where it felt like there were many people not really knowing what was going on, basically, but still building stuff on top of it. And then the community in Berlin also played a huge role, because lots of your listeners will probably have heard of this, but we've had several Lightning hack days. There was also one here in New York.
FOMO hack days, correct?
Yeah, exactly. FOMO are the guys that are organizing it. And they are connected to several people from the Berlin community that were interested in Lightning, and that kind of drew me into that community of Bitcoin in Berlin and Lightning, and really motivated me to kind of take my understanding my understanding to the next level, but also then actually build stuff on top of it.
Yeah, no, it's actually, I feel like we're both spoiled, because behind New York, I think Berlin's probably one of the hottest spots for Bitcoin and all these other projects that are proliferating as well. Do you feel spoiled in Berlin, like with the people that are there?
Yes and no. I would say definitely yes for the community of people. So also in the statistics, I mean, nobody knows how much they are worth, but in the statistics of full nodes being run, Germany's usually pretty high in the ranking. In Berlin, there are lots of people that are building projects on top of it. The only thing that we are maybe missing is larger companies that are employing people to work on Bitcoin open source or like bigger Bitcoin projects, I would say. But the community is great. Meetups are great. If you're around, then please come visit us.
Yeah. And what were you doing before Bitcoin?
Before Bitcoin, I was just working as a software developer. I was...
What kind of systems were you working on?
Just web stuff. So I had some experience with larger companies, but mostly when I was a student. That got me very demotivated about working at a large company. So basically, that was also the reason why I moved to Berlin, was I wanted to work for startups. So I worked for startups as an employee first, and then I became a freelancer. I could switch around even more, see more companies, help even more companies. But these are mostly internet startups. So different tech stacks, but mostly web stuff.
Yeah, and how'd you stumble into Bitcoin? You're saying you think you have a pretty typical story, but who knows? Maybe something different.
Well, I first got a mail by a friend. Let's say not super early, but Probably 2013, 2014, and it was like sometime around when the price had gone up, and he was in Japan at the time, and he had, of course, because of Mt. Gox, some exposure. Like, I think that's how he heard about it, and he told me, like, how about you check this out? And I checked it out, but I unfortunately approached it from the wrong angle. So as I said, I was very much thinking about startups, and also always had in the back of my mind the possibility to start my own project. And so I thought about Bitcoin as something that would enable some new things, as a technology that would enable some new things. But I was kind of thinking about it in a different way that I see it now. So I would say, I guess I saw it as a tool for existing corporations and not as this like whole new playground of like possibilities. I completely underestimated, I would say.
So what do you mean as a tool for incumbent companies? Like, they could just accept Bitcoin and...
Yeah, so I guess I would say that the way I looked at it would be appropriate for machine learning stuff now. So as a way to optimize like certain parts of a company and optimize business operations or so. Mm-hmm. And yeah, didn't really see the bigger picture, or I mean, I cannot really remember the stuff. The only reason I know that I was thinking about it this early is because I still have some notes on my computer. I wouldn't really know that anymore. But yeah, that's just brainstorming about some ideas. You know, it's like, okay, gambling, but then it's you have these headaches with laws, and you have to go to some shady country or whatever, and you know, you can do an exchange, but it's probably going to be very small, and there's already one exchange out there that is working. So yeah, no. So yeah, it seems very crazy from today's perspective.
What led you to your epiphany or your aha moment? Was it Lightning or?
No. It came a bit earlier. So oddly, something that like, I think there are other people that had this experience as well. Is that Ethereum also played a role in it. So when Ethereum came around, and Berlin is very much also Ethereum country, so they have hackerspace there, Parity is based there. So there was a big Ethereum community, and especially in before the DAO came around, like there were lots of presentations. So that kind of got me more interested in the space again, because I saw, okay, there's something else out there. They made large presentations, and it seemed more approachable at the time. And I spent some time looking at that. Then I saw what came of the DAO, and that kind of drew me in even more, because I saw, okay, this is like, it showed me how low my understanding was of the whole space, basically. Yeah.
So the DAO turned you off of Ethereum, or?
I cannot really say that. It was like I saw it as something that was kind of interesting, but I hadn't really looked into it deeply enough to form a real opinion on it. Like, I'm very I really don't want to commit to any opinions usually unless I have a very good understanding of something. With this, it was like that, but I was looking at it pretty curiously and went to some meetups, and so it sounded like something that could be interesting, and but then, you know, like there was a bucket that like made the whole thing crash, and that was like for me, as somebody who was usually when I go to a new company, and I do that routinely as a freelancer, I go deep and I understand the systems, and like, I mean, it could be potentially part of my job to prevent something like this. It was very interesting to me that there were so many people at these meetups and watching these presentations and apparently working on it, and everyone seemed super smart, but still this happened, and like, and how much money was disappearing. It was just very interesting to follow, and led me to have a desire to understand it from a much deeper perspective.
So you've obviously wound up working on Bitcoin. What sort of led you to have a deeper understanding of both Ethereum and Bitcoin? Like, what was your course of direction? Did you start spinning up Solidity, or excuse me, like a parity node and writing in Solidity? Were you jumping into the core code base and sort of figuring out how it worked, or were you looking more at development mentalities, if you will?
I mean, I've spent quite a bit of time to think about, like, does Ethereum make sense or not? What they pitch, does it actually make sense? And then, like many people that are in Bitcoin now, I just at some point realized, like, I cannot come up with something that is a use case that really makes sense to me. And then at the same time, I just understood more and more that the use case of Bitcoin, as it really becomes a store of value and like it's growing in size, it's every year that it survives, basically, it becomes it's
more likely to survive, right?
Yeah, into the future. Exactly, yes. That it's much more relevant, and there's like the only real use case for using a blockchain right now. So it's like by I don't know how you say it, but
via negativa.
Basically, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
No, it's how most people come to do it, right? Like I'm the same way. Like I was very bullish Ethereum till the DAO hack as well. As soon as the DAO hack happened, like this is not right. It's not okay. We should not be pumping this stuff. And then you dig deeper. And so what sort of excites you about Bitcoin in particular from like a technical perspective? From an engineer's perspective, like do you admire the conservative nature of the team and the review process, the contributing, like Bitcoin Core, that process in particular? Do you like working with the engineers who like to work on Bitcoin in particular, or do you feel like you learn more?
I mean, the guys, the people that I've met that are working on Bitcoin are all great. I'm very happy that I can work with specifically the people at Chaincode, but also other people that I've met online and at some conferences. But also, I really cannot like name one specific thing. I would like to say that Bitcoin is like the most interesting software project in the world right now. Not just right now, probably forever. Because there's nothing else out there that can have the impact of Bitcoin, and like the story how it comes about, the fact that it survived 10 years, like this is all so incredible. It's like a freak of nature. That's
right,
crazy.
The fact that the incentives have stayed aligned for the last decade, for at least a decade, is crazy. I forget, somebody was tweeting about that today, but it is, and I think it was Eric Lombroso, actually, who was saying the fact that the incentives have been aligned for a decade is insane for a project as ambitious as Bitcoin. Yeah. So I guess that's like where we can take this. Like, how do you see Bitcoin changing the world? Is there anything that you would consider... maybe not an unpopular opinion, but maybe a lesser known opinion that the way you see Bitcoin changing the world, or how do you just see it changing the world in general?
I'm very much a hands-on guy, so I'm not really thinking that much about like visions of the next 50 or 100 years. So I don't really. Yeah, I would say that's kind of a waste of time to think about that, because I'm trying to understand the code base right now, and I'm thinking about like short term. Of course, I would not be excited about it if I wouldn't see it as something that is solving people's problems. On the one hand, one thing that I always like to name is that it's fascinating that we had the refugee crisis in Europe, and so just to imagine that somebody, at least in theory, coming from Africa and crossing the border to Europe on foot or so, that they, if they had the ability, and I'm not saying that it's easy, but if they had the ability to change some of their wealth to Bitcoin, they could basically memorize the phrase and just walk across the border basically like naked, but they could still have all their wealth with them, or at least like some fraction of their wealth. That is just extremely fascinating, and there was this like definitely one of the things that also motivated me to look into it deeper when the refugee crisis was coming about. And then, for states that are experiencing inflation, hyperinflation, Bitcoin doesn't even have to become like this huge world currency or so. It just needs to be something that is an alternative for people, that even if it's just the wealthiest 10,000 or so of the country that get to change some of their wealth and like keep the state from diluting it. But yeah, that already can have an impact.
It's so crazy how powerful it is, and the fact that like most people, because Bitcoin isn't widespread, don't grasp the power of this. And I guess that's why I do this podcast and the newsletter, and why you code is to make you code to make the system stronger, I would imagine. And I'm doing this podcast to help people sort of try to grasp the magnitude of this. Like, it's a big innovation.
Yeah.
And like, so do you find yourself explaining Bitcoin to people a lot at home, or are you more of a I work on some code, I'm a tech guy?
I don't find myself explaining it to that many people. One thing is funnily the people that I would like to explain it the most are my two younger brothers, and unfortunately they sort of say it's boring.
why do they say that?
Well, they are into robotics and they want to work on software that moves robot arms, and so they think that that's more exciting. And so I haven't been successful in making them interested in Bitcoin.
How much younger than you are there?
They're 10 years younger. They're in college right now.
Oh, nice. They'll come around. Maybe they'll need to know the importance of. They'll come to notice the importance of sound money in the digital age. And
yeah.
But robotics is pretty cool. Are they working on like drones and stuff, or
not drones. The older one is working on like some innovative robot arm that can kind of like sense. So it's built so like when you're very old, that it can help you basically get off the toilet without, like, if it malfunctions or so, like breaking your arm or stuff like that.
I was perusing Twitter today, and I saw a video of a team in Japan is working on building a quasi tail for elderly people to help them with their balance, like when they're walking, and like self-corrects, it like mimics the tail of like a macaw monkey, not a macaw monkey, or like some monkey. And just like is trying to help the elderly with balance for like when they, or the disabled too, like if they're about to fall over, it will like balance for you. And it's crazy. Like, do you believe in like a cyborg future? Do you think we're going to become cyborgs? I actually just interviewed Brian Bishop last weekend, and he got big into transhumanism, and I've never been introduced to transhumanism, and a lot of this stuff was new to me. But like, to think the tech is getting there where we can like combine with this stuff is crazy. I mean, your brother's working on it, so.
Yeah, I mean, like, that's inevitable. I mean, like, this already, we can already see that out there, right? Like, there's these, like, suits that enhance your strength for lifting up things for warehouse workers. And, like, you get, heart rate monitors and like, hearing aids and stuff like that. And there's no reason why, even if you cannot imagine it, like, you're probably just underestimating it. Like, there will be something for everything that you need in your body that can be replaced by some kind of machine probably in the future.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like the one question I asked them. They said it was... Brian had a friend on who's a huge transhumanist. I thought we were going to turn into a transhumanism podcast for the rest of our tenure here, but now they were big on like it's inevitable and we're going to merge with machines. It's crazy to think. It's crazy to think how much our life or the world has changed during our lifetimes. I think we're about the same age. And just like I remember when we got, I've said this on this podcast many times, but I remember when we got caller ID at our house, and I thought that was fucking insane. I was like, oh my God. Aunt Lisa's calling us. We can see it. But like now, we're like,
supercomputers in our pockets, Bitcoin exists. Like, how much more drastic of changes do you think we'll see in our lifetime? Like,
wow. I honestly, the best answer I can give is that I've accepted that I cannot fathom. I cannot imagine it. Like, this is I just try to remind myself all the time that I'm probably, if I would think of something that is like what that future would look like in like 50 years or so, then I would probably totally underestimate it. I mean, it's the only thing where I've looked into it deeper, where I've maybe like been too optimistic, was self-driving cars. I mean, like, to
what's that?
Self-driving cars.
Oh, self-driving cars. Yeah.
Yeah. So like there, I saw them almost like driving around, like around this time when we saw like bigger leaps in the past couple of years.
When I was like early in my Bitcoin career, shilling it to others, that was one of my, I remember there was a huge post about self-driving cars and they're going to like drive around with Bitcoin wallets and like you're going to own a self-driving car. And then that would be able to, while you're at work or school, go to work and like be like an Uber-like service where you send it around and it has a Bitcoin wallet that accepts Bitcoin payments. And it's just like autonomous while you're at work, and then when you're done work, it'll come pick you up and give you a free ride home. That was how I'd pitch it. So I'm like, this is going to be here in like 10 years, but I don't think we're that close.
But also what you also have to realize is like, what's even more exciting, I think, then is like how it's going to change the whole, like our whole life. Then like, not just that the car is driving by itself, but also that, we probably won't even own a car anymore. I mean, that's not a new insight, but like then there's just can be like one, let's just say Uber fleet or whatever, that is driving everyone around, and you just own a fraction of that, not on a blockchain, but and you just use it whenever you need to. And then people also don't need to live in Manhattan anymore. They can live more outside because everything is going to
autonomous,
be optimized, and you know, people. We'll move outside of the city, and
I hear Stephen Toole is bringing Slockit back from the dead, and they're gonna bring this car, the blockchain future, to the future, to us. Excuse me. Yeah, that's what. There's been a lot of talk about Ethereum project in particular the last couple of days. Udi Werthmeyer going hard
must
at them.
Must be very entertaining.
Udi's very smart and very very witty as well. So go check out his profile if you're looking to see the inconsistencies of ETH narrative get called out. It's interesting.
Yeah, I met Udi actually at Riga last year.
Yeah, that's where I met him as well. I'm surprised we didn't. Did we meet officially last year?
I don't think so.
Neither do I. But I'm happy to meet you now. I'm happy you're here. So let's dive more into like the summer. What have you learned about Bitcoin Core this summer? Like, what's been the most challenging thing for you?
Probably most challenging thing overall was that I wasn't a professional C++ programmer, and I still am not. But I definitely have learned a lot of C++ also.
Have you worked with it at all in the past, or?
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, I've learned lots of different languages, and at some point, like, you kind of adapt pretty quickly to just being able to skim the code. I mean, I'm not saying that it's super easy, and just pick up C++ on the fly, but you've seen kind of the different schemes and paradigms at some point, and so you kind of can figure out. Sometimes you look into the reference, and I definitely was struggling a bit in the beginning to kind of use my tools efficiently. But I kind of tackled that with building my own reference. So especially debugging and how to debug Bitcoin, that is aside from my project that I'm working on, what you talked already, is the other thing that I'm pretty proud of that I've done over the summer is I've built basically a reference of how to log and debug efficiently from Bitcoin. So it's like a I would say a good starter reference for people that want to get into Bitcoin but haven't had much experience with C++ or in general with Bitcoin code base. And so, yeah, actually, I've given a presentation on that also at a meetup. And I will also talk about that in Tel Aviv at Dev++.
So what are the benefits of creating a debugger and a logger that help you learn? Like, what do you have to architect it in a certain way that just forces you to read through the code, or
It's not really creating one; it's just using them efficiently. Yeah. And so, it's, what confused me in the beginning is you have these different contexts in Bitcoin of running your own Bitcoin D, or running unit tests, or running the functional tests. And then you may want to log from within the test, or you may want to log from within the C++ or from the Bitcoin D. And so then you have to use different functions, and there are other things that you have to pay attention to. And so especially if you want to run a functional test and have the function test basically drive the Bitcoin D instance to the point where you want to inspect it. That is kind of hard to then set a breakpoint in the Bitcoin D instance and then be able to inspect it because you don't really have access to that Bitcoin D instance naturally. So that's like That took me a while to figure out, and of course I asked several chain coders to describe it to me like three times or so. But now I've written it down, and several people have used it. So I mean, I can briefly describe it. It's actually not that hard, but you have to start the functional test. You stop the functional test with a PDB, just the Python debugger. And then you have to find the PID of the Bitcoin D process that is running in the background that the functional test has spun up. And then you have to attach to that using a debugger like GDB or LLDB. Then you can set your breakpoint there and let that continue. Then you let the PDB breakpoint that you've set before in the functional test continue. And then the Bitcoin D instance is going to run into that breakpoint that you've set. So
it seems like you've memorized this process.
Yes.
The back of your hand.
Well, I wrote a presentation on it, and I had all the slides drawn out, and then John Newbery had the idea that I give that I demonstrated live. And I had
successful live demo.
Perfectly memorized. I had successful live demos five times before the actual presentation, and then the actual presentation, of course, it didn't work.
That's the way it works. That's always the biggest joke at BitDev, is that that's what you get when you do a live presentation or live demo.
Yeah, but then I could still figure it out. But that was really great that I was talking about this topic, because it was something that I thought about so much, and now I'm using it every day. Like, I'm basically right now, when I work on my project, I'm like, really today I was probably 50% of the time I was just in the debugger stepping through the code, and I think that's also why I wrote this stuff down, because it's a very effective way to learn, because you really, when you're in the debugger and you can inspect the variables and just try out calls, you have a much different view than when you just read the code, and it's just a great way to learn and understand everything.
And do you think being in the environment at Chaincode helped bootstrap your knowledge quicker than would have happened outside?
Absolutely, it's an absolute game changer.
Yeah. What's the environment? Like, that was my favorite part of the boot camps, where you have people, like-minded people coming from different backgrounds with different expertise, and just being able to congregate in a corner, like, yeah, walk me through this. And like, for Bitcoin developers, I got to imagine it's pretty, like, even more intense, because there's so many areas on Bitcoin that one individual can be working on.
Yeah. I mean, so first of all, it's amazing that there are that many people present that are serious contributors to Bitcoin. I mean, there are just not that many in the world, basically, and they are all there. What's great is like you don't want to disturb them all the time, right? You don't want to tap on their shoulders all the time when they are focused. But what we've done is we have office hours in the afternoon, so that's basically one of them just gives like an hour of the time or so that they are approachable and you can ask them anything you like. And I definitely have used that, and other people have too. And then over lunch, you just have discussions quite a bit. Other things that we've done also is we are encouraged to of course review each other's code. And John Newberry also does the PR Review Club, which is a great initiative. I also encourage everyone to participate in that as well. Almost everyone in the office is viewing that also. So the PR Review Club, to anyone who doesn't know, is an IRC meetup basically. Every week one PR on Bitcoin Core is reviewed together, and people can ask questions, and John directs the discussion a bit into interesting views on it. And
what's an IRC code review like? That's, I feel like it's got to be very thorough, number one, because you have to write everything out. But like doing a code review over chat is fascinating to me.
Yeah, it's. You can look at the logs. I wouldn't have thought that it works that well, but it works very well. I mean, like, I think it's not so great if you're a very slow typer. Encourages you to change that.
Brian Bishop giving lessons to everybody.
Yeah, exactly. Brian Bishop coding typing camp.
It's fast. I saw you guys. The pleasure of seeing him in action over the weekend. It's very, very impressive. Yeah. What was I just gonna say? I had something lined up to ask you.
IRC review.
Oh yes, this is what it was. I forget who told me. Maybe it was Brian Bishop who told me. I forget who told me exactly, but apparently Andrew Chow's doing Twitch code reviews now.
Yeah.
Over Twitch.
Yeah, it's pretty funny. Like, he's mostly just complaining about
big wallet guy, right?
Forgetting to recompile. But no. Seriously, it's great that he does that. Definitely. What would be even better, or like somebody just needs to do that, is like a compressed view, like, you know, with the NFL games, they take like 4 hours, but then there's like compressed games, like where they just throw the actual plays. For large parts of the time, he's just like, you know, copying code blocks and running recompilation. Other than that, especially if you're into wallet code and want to understand hardware wallet, HWI stuff better, I think that's...
And he's working on pre-signed transactions too, right?
Sorry?
He's working on some with pre-signed transactions too, right?
PSBT. It's that code, and like the stuff that I've seen that he has done was a very large pull request that he has, and I think it was 70 commits, which is crazy.
Why is that crazy? What's a typical?
I mean, there's no typical thing. I mean, I haven't really seen the commits. I haven't reviewed it. But something that you just know as a developer is just if there's like a huge number of commits, let's say more than 10, like just the number of people that are going to review it is just decreasing, because it's just
too much.
So huge, that people are just... Probably they're saying like, I'm not going to do this today. I'm going to do it tomorrow or whatever. But that just keeps happening. So for that video, he was trying to get it down to like 30 or 40, I think. pull requests that I've seen, for example, for block filters or so, which is something that was recently merged. Like there were three pull requests of 7 to 12 commits or so. I mean, that was already a bigger thing, right? That's a pretty big feature that is coming into Bitcoin. And if you then put that into relation, that's just 70 commits in one PR, it's pretty crazy.
And are they all like contingent on another? Like you have like a domino effect. Like if one messes up, it could mess up other commits. So you probably want to reduce your attack surface via the number of it commits as well. Is that correct? Am I correct in assuming that? Or
I'm not sure I understand.
Like, is there a, for the 70 commits, is like one, like, do they need to happen in a certain order?
You mean like for one, the, for one is conti- so the CI doesn't
like fail? Number 70 is contingent on number 69, which is contingent on number 68 for all of its work, or they, would they all get?
Yeah, probably. I mean, I haven't looked into it that deeply, so yeah. And I also, I haven't followed that video. I just he had one 4-hour session, and I just I kept it on for some time in the background, and it was kind of entertaining.
Now I remember who told us this. It was Rodolfo told us this. And I bet it's because he was paying attention because he's working on a hardware wallet. So, yeah. But that is a fascinating idea, like code review via Twitch. It's crazy how many avenues through which you can learn, like the IRC, like if you want to type it out, you can do that. I mean, obviously it's only Andrew Chow doing it.
I think
Twitch
also
right
Lisa
now.
Nygut from Sea Lightning was doing it. I haven't seen recordings of that, but I think she also did that.
Yeah. Oh, it makes sense, right? It's a great avenue. And so what's your favorite way to learn? Like hands-on video, visual learner? Reading.
Yeah, I'm definitely visual in the beginning. I have issues with keeping my focus on text for a very long time, but then also quickly jumping into just applying it yourself. But for that, it's also important that it's a project that is kind of interesting and. Also good if I have like something that I can look at as like a guideline or so, but I feel like that's the best way for me to learn.
Yeah. Now I'm a very visual learner as well. I learned that in college. I use the Khan Academy a lot to help teach myself economics, and other resources. But so what's the next 11 days looking like for you? Like you have or 12 days or 11 days. March 20th. So yeah, 11 days left of the residency. Or is it the residency or the boot camp? I'm getting confused.
It's a residency.
It's a residency. Yeah. The residency. What are you like sprinting right now? Trying to get everything in, or is it something like you're just going to get it to a certain point and then keep working on it after?
Yeah, definitely going to keep working on it after. So the expectations. For I think most of us are not that, or already were weeks ago that wasn't going to get in, but rather that we maybe could open a PR or get feedback at least on something that could become a PR soon, and so that's what it looks like for me right now. So I'm really trying in this week to get something ready that can get through the first PRs. For the first reviews, and also I'm probably going to make a gist that is going to describe just broadly what I've done, the different approaches that I looked at, and hopefully also some benchmarks, which I still have to do, and then I'm going to propose that to Bitcoin developers meetup that is also on IRC. Try to get some feedback. So far this is the best idea that I have to get it out there, get feedback from the people where I need to get some involvement in order to actually get it into the code base. I mean, it's something that you just need to think about if you have something that was already proposed once by SIPA and then people didn't really pay much attention to it, and then now you come as somebody pretty new and I kind of have to play it a bit strategically. Yeah.
And if you play it strategically and all goes well and the PR does get merged, what does this mean for Bitcoin? Like what are devs working on or users using it going to be able to leverage?
Well, definitely the get TX outside info call is going to emerge quicker. Mm-hmm. That potentially can be used then for definitely fast BTC pay server, which may or may not be obsolete when assume UTXO comes around, but still. GetTX outset info hash can be used for other quick checks of comparing the UTXO set, and that can even be potentially be done then through the peer-to-peer layer, because it's not going to be a DOS vector anymore, because it's just a value that is cached. There potentially can be more use cases on it that I haven't thought about yet. It's something that where I can see other people using it, where I just haven't had any idea about it.
It's so fascinating, like little things like this RPC call could consume like your summer, but it all contributes to the bigger thing. So like if you were to be successful in this endeavor, if even unsuccessful or unsuccessful after a certain period of time, or the PR just sits there, what else would you want to work on at Encore or Lightning Network? What do you want to build?
It's hard to say. Like, I have things that I find more interesting than other things, but I also look at the code base, especially of Core, and I still see a lot of things that can be improved, even if they're just smaller things. I've been a freelancer for a couple of years, and I have seen lots of different code bases from lots of different startups, and I always approach that with kind of like a mentality where you leave it better than you found it. Boy Scout mentality.
What's that?
Boy Scout rule.
The Boy Scout?
Boy Scout rule?
Boy Scout rule. Yes, that is Boy Scout rule.
Yeah.
Eagle Scout rule. Yeah.
Okay.
Eagle Scout, Boy Scout, yeah.
Yeah. Just smaller things. Like I don't have to work on a huge feature right now unless like I'm something jumps at me and I say that's right, like I see that that's necessary and I'm the right person to work on it, then I'm going to do that. Otherwise I can also see myself just helping improve the test coverage, helping with separation of processes, which is a huge project that is being worked on, just refactorings, fixing smaller bugs. I'm just happy to improve it, make Bitcoin more stable and usable for everyone, and don't need to work on a huge feature.
Well, thank you for helping out Bitcoin and working on it. It's crazy. That's what blows my mind, especially the developers contributing to Core. Like, there's nobody there to pay you. Obviously, chain codes brought you in this summer, but after the residency, like, you're sort of on your own, and yeah, you're going to have to make money. Like, how do you plan on like having a full-time job and work on Bitcoin on the side, or are you going to try to go full-time?
I definitely get a full-time job working on Bitcoin, yeah.
Yeah. So,
no, I'm I mean, like, that would be great. Of course, would be awesome to get paid to work on Bitcoin on open source stuff. I don't have that lined up yet. So I'm looking into that, into the possibilities, and Chaincode is also helping with that. I don't know yet. I only know that I'm going to keep working on Bitcoin.
Yeah, I mean, the Chaincode model seems to work. I mean, it does a great job of finding talented devs and then nurturing them, if you will. And do you see that across your classmates as well? Like, people have grown a lot this summer and developed as developers, and understand their understanding of Bitcoin has developed as well.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I was already very impressed on the first day when I met all these guys. They were already impressive at that point. Some of them already had contributed to open source projects, and others just had very deep knowledge. They're very impressive. I think what everyone definitely profited from a lot was just the access to the Chaincode team, getting full-time commitment to work on Bitcoin and or whatever other projects they chose. I think that made everyone much more comfortable in working in that environment.
No, I had the pleasure of sitting down with James Chang last week, and
yeah.
what he's working on, Taproot, for like a testnet for Taproot, basically, is really cool. And what is like the coolest thing outside of what you're working on that you see being built at the residency or worked on?
I'm not really sure. I have to say I don't have so deep insights into what they actually built, not for everyone. So that's why there's some bias there.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have a big insight into what everyone's doing. Like somebody definitely I have to highlight is a person that likes to values privacy, but he goes by Ariad on GitHub, and he's kind of contributing to Rust projects, but also Bitcoin Core, has a huge output there and is very productive and is achieving a lot. Somebody else where I have some deeper insight is Richard Myers, and he's working on L2 demo basically.
Yeah, Lab 49.
Yeah, like Lot 49 is the project that he's working on before, like the concept. And for the residency, he's building like a L2 demo, basically. Yeah. So Lot 49 builds on L2, but L2 is not there yet. So he is basically building like an L2 demo.
Yeah.
L2 so far was just a paper, and he's putting it into code.
Yeah, no, L2, E-L-T-O-O. We actually had Richard on a few weeks ago to talk about that. He's another one who did the residency and seems invigorated almost, right? But he said it was daunting, right? Or not daunting, but like tiring. Like it's long days. You're a lot of pressure. You're with a group of very talented individuals, and it just seems like a great environment. So I'm happy for you. I'm pumped because again, I remember the smiles on your guys' faces like the first time you guys came to town and. To see that summer's been worthwhile, I'm pumped for you guys.
We just like I mean when I get stuck on an issue for half a day or so, you know, it's like I sometimes also feel stressed, you know, because I want to get progress and it's just 2 weeks left. But on the other hand, you know, we just have to remind ourselves how privileged we are to have this summer and have access to the resources and sit in this awesome office and. Then you know we have reason to smile again.
How have you been like in New York City outside of the residency?
Great. I have to say it's not my first time in New York, so I didn't really do that much touristy things. Still enjoying it. Great to live here and experience that part of it. I think it just feels different when you live for an extensive time and. Not just a tourist looking at museums or whatever.
Yeah, once you get used to like the smelly hot summer days, become a real New Yorker. Have the rats scared you at all? You got any rat problems?
No, I mean we also have rats in Berlin, so it's it's not that different.
We need to find a chain code in Berlin. That's what I'm happy to see like Square Crypto come. Like, obviously, chain code Blockstream before it. Like, do you think it is imperative for Bitcoin's long-term success not imperative, but beneficial for Bitcoin's long-term success for more and more of these initiatives to pop up?
Yeah, yes and no. I mean, yes, definitely, but it doesn't have to be Berlin necessarily. I think trend overall, but also in Bitcoin development, is like people work remote, so... lots of people that contribute a lot, I think, or that could be potential very good contributors, still have issues to make it somewhere. There were also issues with some people that would have been participants in residency that had issues with the visa. Setting something up that is remote can help people too. I mean, there's definitely huge benefits to getting everyone in the same place and kind of get this squad mentality, mm-hmm. but it's just harder if you have a family or so. Not everyone can do that. And
Luke Dash Jr. is being supported now by like a crowd fund out of China, I believe. Is that correct? I think Carl Dong was telling me about that.
I actually don't know who he's supported by. I just heard that he's supported by someone, but I don't really know.
I think that's the case. I think it's a bunch of like well-off Bitcoiners in China and East Asia that had a Telegram group. I think Dovi Wan was a part of it too.
It just makes huge sense for anyone who has a lot of Bitcoin to support a core contributor. It's just
incentivized to do so. Right? And you're not securing. You're number one, securing. Number two, making it a better investment. So I guess that's a good segue question is like, what worries you about Bitcoin? Like, what is there anything you find is pressing and worrying from a engineering perspective that would maybe hinder Bitcoin's long term success?
Not really. I mean, I think Bitcoin is in a pretty good place right now. I mean, there can always be things improved, of course, but nothing really comes to mind right now that is like absolutely necessary. I mean, we are talking a lot about Taproot and stuff like that. This is not something that we really need necessarily. You know, like Bitcoin is working fine without it right now. So I think that shows that we don't have like a huge thing that we need to fix, sort of like SegWit did.
Yeah, it's very comforting to hear. No, and that's at the conference over the weekend too at BitBlock Boom, Mike Schmidt gave a great presentation on Taproot and Schnorr, and it would be so cool the things that it would enable if it was implemented. But like you said, it's not imperative, but it would be pretty dope if we could get
definitely. On the other hand, we still have time, right? I would be the first one to see these things in Bitcoin this year, but on the other hand,
I'm gonna put the pressure on you right now.
Okay,
Fabian,
I'll do it.
For BIP Taproot, how do we get it? How do we
this
get it
weekend.
Merged? What is the
2 weeks typical?
what would you propose as a signaling method or a soft fork agreement to get that implemented? Because that's like the big question right now. I was like, this proposal, SIPA proposed it. What, like a month, 2 months ago now, or maybe even 3 months ago now at this point. And it seems like everybody's like, we want Schnorr, we want Taproot, and all that other stuff that's in there. But it's like, how do you get a signaling mechanism to get the network to vote on whether, not vote, but to reach consensus on whether or not it should be implemented?
Wow, I think I have to pass on that because I really haven't thought about that much. It's really, it's a difficult question, and I just really haven't thought about it a lot.
No, and it's also it's a hard question to answer after SegWit, right? Because it was a very messy signaling process, and obviously getting it passed. So we had SegWit 2x. Yeah. What do we have? So we have BIP 9, which was the BIP used for miners to signal, which is version bits, basically binary option.
Yeah,
they single one way or the other, but you found like Wang Chung from F2 pool was messing with the version bits and was basically messing with the signaling. Then on top of that, you had all different BIPs from BIP 91, BIP 148, BIP 149, BIP 90, which are all part of it, and it was all a mess trying to get SegWit merged and implemented. So like, I think there's a lot of battle scars still from that, and I think that's why I asked you, because that's like, I've asked John Newberry before, BitDevs, that's been asked before too, and it's sort of a question nobody wants to even approach right now. It's like, I don't want to be the one to recommend how we signal this, which is fascinating, right?
Yeah, I mean, like comparing it to SegWit, so far, and also I think there's not really, or I don't tend to see like groups forming that are really fighting over it. That might still develop. I mean, like on like what I said before, I think Bitcoin is in kind of a good place right now, and so if it ain't broke,
don't fix it type mentality.
Yeah, if we don't really need it, like we don't have. I mean, use cases are cool, but we don't really need them. So if you have a lot of Bitcoin and you don't want them to go away. It is kind of rational to say you don't want to introduce any big changes unless they either like triple your money or
What about privacy? So I think like Schnorr, that's why I think Schnorr and Taproot, I would put them more leaning towards not good to haves, but probably need to haves because of the privacy issue. Like I think P2EP would be huge if you could just have every transaction be a pay to endpoint, basically every transaction be a coin join, and it would really obscure the chain analysis companies and their ability to track transactions throughout the chain. So that is my, and this is my personal belief. I am adult. Anybody who listens to this podcast knows I am adult. But it would seem to me that once you have very strong, plausible deniability and privacy assurances at the protocol level enabled by Schnorr and Taproot, then we can sort of hit escape velocity and be like, there's no way you can throttle this. But yeah. you can also have the chain stay as it is in perpetuity and have your transactions somewhat known at the protocol level and then gain obscurity on levels like Lightning Network and stuff like that. But I think...
Yeah, but in, like, unfortunately from our perspective, I think there are also quite a few players that have possession of a lot of Bitcoin that don't really care about privacy, right? And yeah. So, I mean, like every exchange that does KYC doesn't care about privacy improvements. So that's...
It's a very good point. And they have a lot of the Bitcoin.
Yeah. Yeah, and so that's something that, we have to keep in mind. Like, that's potentially where conflict could come from.
Well, that's where it came from last time,
I don't
right?
want to be the one to start it now.
Fabian, let's come on. Just do it. Pull the trigger.
Okay. The war is on.
Just send it.
The privacy wars. Taproot privacy.
I mean,
wars.
I've been saying this for a year. That's going to be the next big battle. It's just, when's it going to start? That's the question. Because again, that's actually a very good point. I haven't thought of, like, the exchange is trying to hold it up because maybe they won't quote unquote be compliant at that point in their eyes. But again, they only have so many full nodes, right?
It could also be just somebody, like, again, I don't want to be the one to encourage someone to do that, but I mean, like,
Shallon Fry?
Well, just like see it as an opportunity to just do a fork. Like, even if you don't believe in it, you could just do a fork that doesn't do it, and just I mean, it's gonna have some value, and you probably can make some money from it. It is, of course, it's not hard to do.
I bet there'll be Rhett Creighton. Rhett Creighton, Bitcoin privacy and that whole. He was a serial forker for Gain. Bitcoin Private was the big one that he forked off and didn't know there was an inflation bug. And I think they printed like 2 million more Bitcoin than they should have. That was an interesting time in Bitcoin when all the Bitcoin forks were hot. Bitcoin Gold, Bitcoin Private, Bitcoin Cash, obviously. It's interesting to see where they've added up. Did you see Bitcoin.com or excuse me, the @Bitcoin handle on Twitter started deleting all their Bcash support?
Really? I don't know. Yeah. I don't follow that.
Yeah, you're not big on Twitter. That was actually, so if you freaks out there, a lot of the research I do is based off of tweets and Twitter, and you only have 116 tweets, so it was your GitHub and that and the conversation that we had in the beginning of the summer that I had to go off.
Yeah, I mean, but I think it's going well, so.
It's going great, man.
I mean, like, it's, forks, it's crazy when people just tell me that these people actually exist. Like, I still have a hard time believing that. Like, the only thing I can go off is, like, when I go on Meetup and I search for Bitcoin Meetup on the page, like, there's a Bcash Meetup where 100 people are members of that group. And then the other thing was I found kind of amusing was that right in front of my house, there's a supermarket in Berlin. And in front of that supermarket, there are a couple of steel pillars. And just one day, there were just all of these steel pillars were full of Bcash stickers. and I was like, did they find me or something? Like, this? I got really paranoid.
The Bcashers are taunting you at work.
Really? I mean, like, there was like in total like 8 Bcash stickers. So what would you say if like on the street down here there would be like 8 Bcash stickers like right in front of your entrance door, like on every corner?
I'd move out. There's too many bad neighbors. You can't trust them at that point.
Yeah.
Too many Bcashers. That's what I'm actually looking to see. I would love to see a mining, like a 51% attack. I said it, whatever. Like the stuff's possible, like with proof of work. Like that's the next thing I'm interested to see if pools or dark pools start attacking chains, just because you look at it, like that's the crazy thing about Bitcoin Cash and Bitcoin SV in particular. And even though a lot of their proponents are extremely loud, if you look at the hash rate, Bitcoin has 97% of the SHA-256 hash rate, and those two are fighting for the last three. And you only need, what, like 5 to 6% of current Bitcoin hash rate to completely school both those chains. And that's actually something that surprised me 10 years in, is that 51% attacks by dominant chains or dominant chains has not been executed at all. Do you see proof of work warfare heating up in the future?
I don't really know. I mean, like it would, like it's actually surprising that there are not more attacks. I think we've like that has been one of the topics of our residency of. Presentations that we've had in this ramp-up phase, but also now later on, and there's going to be some interesting new research also going to be released soon. Like I said, it's actually surprising that there's not more going on. I mean, like so many people just want to see the world burn, and there's actually weird that there's not more going on, sort of.
Right? Are you allowed to? Give us a sneak peek of the research that's going to come out. Where
I don't really know if I'm allowed to. It's okay. A private presentation, so.
All right, I'm not going to force you to do that then.
But yeah, it's also going to be interesting. Like right now, obviously the market has gone down for a long time. Now it has gone up, and also from macroeconomic perspective, right now the markets are like it feels like also for a long time.
Germany in particular, man. You have Deutsche Bank at all-time lows and all your treasury yields negative right now, which is so weird.
Although you can give me your money and give you back less in 10 years. Yeah? I mean, I'm German, so it's
do you want $100 now or 90 cents later? It is. I mean, it's coming from traditional markets. It is scary where it is right now. And that's actually something that worries me, like, with Bitcoin in particular as a safe haven, like, do you think it's ready to be an escape vote for if there is like an economic downturn and there is a lot of people trying to come onto the network? Like, how do we onboard not even a billion people, like even if it's the next 100 million people? Because we saw in 2017 when the price was going crazy then, like the exchanges were going down. Obviously, fees went up. Fees going up is not necessarily a bad thing, but blocks started slowing down a little bit because there was a lot of congestion. Obviously, SegWit proliferating since then has helped, and other things have helped since then become more efficient. But like, do you think we're ready to scale to like 100 million people, 200 million people? And if so, how? Like, do you think more people will be onboarded via Lightning or the protocol layer?
Also, one of the questions that I don't concern myself with that much, because let's not kid ourselves. Like, if 100 million people come into Bitcoin, 95 of them at least are going to be on exchanges, and it's just going to be depending on the how efficient these exchanges then handle what they actually put on the blockchain.
Yeah.
And like since we had these huge congestions in 2017, I feel like it's gone a lot better. And also, obviously, to shill something else from Chaincode, Optech also is contributing by educating exchanges about how to improve even more. So, yeah, it's. I mean, of course, we can see full mempools, high fees again. But if, as you say, lots of people try to use Bitcoin as a safe haven, I think that doesn't mean that a lot of people will spin up full nodes, because that's not what these people are looking for. They're just looking for a store of value. But
exposure to it, they don't need to hold it.
Yeah. So especially if like the markets are going to crash and actually Bitcoin turns out to be the asset that they go to, I think it wouldn't really have that much of an impact in terms of like the number of full nodes that are being run and the number of transactions that get into the block. I mean, it's also unfortunate for somebody who's running a full node and would like to see more people doing that. But that's the reality, I think.
Very very honest of you. Like, I think, no, everybody, I'd like to envision people running their own full nodes too, and it actually might work out in our favor where people just gain access via the exchanges. And yes, hopefully OpTec has done an incredible job of educating and making people aware of batching, using BEC32 addresses and being as efficient as possible when transacting on the blockchain. But maybe that could also work in our favor where people aren't comfortable running their own full nodes, and maybe over time they come to realize. That's what I think happens. Like, it's an education process. Like, no one's ever had to take self-sovereignty of their financials before. In custody, since like we were on a gold standard, but even when we were on a gold standard, like it was in exchanges or banks. And I think Bitcoin sort of incentivizes people to learn and take extreme ownership over their being, so that people can get it on exchanges and then slowly but surely move it to their own private keys. Maybe that's the way you onboard the next 100 million people, slowly, one step at a time, stepping stones.
Yeah, you need, like, typical marketing thing, you need lots of different touch points, sort of. And my first touch point was somebody sending me an email because it went up 10x. Then my next touch point was thinking about it in terms of startup ideas. And then at some point, I understood what it's really about. And so people will see it as maybe just a way to conserve their wealth for some time, through proxy of some company, but then maybe when the economy goes down and like states where they are, they fear some scrutiny, or they are not sure that the funds are going to be safe at the exchange that they have chosen, then they are going to look at hardware wallets or whatever is going to be around at the time as a way to save the funds in a safe way that is convenient for them, and I think then they are going to own their own keys eventually.
I'd agree. The world had to learn to clean itself. When we got fresh plumbing, we had to learn how to wipe our butts, take showers, brush our teeth. It'll take time to learn how to take custody of your private keys and do sort of data sanitation, if you will. What was I going to say? Second time I've lost my train of thought here.
Taking a shower.
No, I was thinking like into the future. Like, so let's get cosmic here. Like, do you see Bitcoin taking us to space? I've read a draft of a good friend of the podcast, Drew Brunsall's writing a piece about Bitcoin in space, and he seems to think that Bitcoin finally creates the incentive for us to go to space and explore space. Do you agree with that?
I think I've already said like 5 times or so that I don't concern myself with things that
are
too far away. And space is pretty far away.
Yeah.
So
I'm a romantic. I like to daydream. I'm sorry for trying to force you to.
That's okay.
We're almost like an hour and 20 minutes in here. Like, what, is there anything like that we didn't touch on that you'd like to touch on before we? Anything, any messages you want to impart?
I thought you wanted to talk maybe a little bit about Lightning. We can do that.
Yeah.
I can...
like, what is the state... Yeah. What are your current thoughts on Lightning? Like, we just got watchtowers added. An LND. After speaking to the Noddle guys a couple months ago, Michael in particular seems to think, like, channel routing, like, isn't ideal right now. Like, what... After building on it, you've built on it a bunch. Like, like, let's start there. So you work with Renee Picard on... that's the one tweet I found, is you interacting with Renee in a thread about, like, bar 77.
Room 77.
That's the Bitcoin bar in Berlin, correct?
Yeah, exactly.
So what's the vibe like there?
Yeah, it's awesome there. I love it. I mean, that's where the monthly Bitcoin meetup is happening. Anyone who is visiting Berlin and into Bitcoin definitely has to stop by there. I don't remember when they started accepting Bitcoin as payment, but it was probably like 2011 or so. So they are they're as OG as it can get. I think at some point, like somebody said, also they are the first bar to actually like accept Bitcoin on a regular basis. I mean, like they didn't sell the pizza, but I mean that was a one-time thing. But they have been around for a very long time. It's a great place. You probably don't even have to be there for the meetup. You if you just sit at a couch and ask someone at any given night if they are into Bitcoin, then you would probably find someone in a bar. Yeah.
So what part of Berlin is this bar in?
Kreuzberg,
of course.
Yeah, it's it's easy to find.
So you worked on something on Lightning to help create like an invoicing system for them? It was like
This particular was that you're referencing was a Hack Day project. That was Renee's idea, there was a system that had just come out. I'm just blanking on the name now, but it was built. There was just a UI project on top of C Lightning that you could also run a container, and he basically wanted to build a system with that where you could offer that as a service, just a custodial Lightning service, basically. This is almost a year ago now, or 1 year ago, so there were not really that many apps out there. We just spun that up over these 1.5 days, and I mean, like, it wasn't a huge project. We also attended some presentation. Rene even gave a presentation at the Lightning Hack Day there, at the end of it, Room 77 was using it to receive payments with Lightning, and it was the first. I guess we haven't heard of anyone else accepting a mainnet payment, Lightning payment for a beer prior to that. Actually, Room 77 had been the place also where Lalu had demoed Lightning also, but there was testnet.
Okay.
But they are taking that further and further. I've seen now on Twitter just 1 or 2 days ago that at the last meetup, they have demoed like a hardware version, so it's based on the M5 stack. If you've heard of that, it's like a stackable hardware set that is based on ESP32, where you can have like a small display and like some buttons, they basically can generate an invoice on that. It's connected to a Lightning node, and they're using that now to accept payments.
Oh, nice.
There's a video on Twitter. It's pretty cool.
That's not what Mortiz is working on, is it?
Sorry?
That's not what that guy Mortiz is working on, is it? No. He's working on like a hardware wallet / Lightning node, I believe.
The guy who I know is a BTC Socialist.
Whoa.
Well, he's from London, but he's in Berlin quite frequently, and he likes to hack on hardware stuff, and he collaborates also with FOMO guys on events and on hacking on hardware, and I think definitely he was involved in that. Like, he has a couple of YouTube videos on that, on how to build hardware projects with Lightning. Definitely something worth checking out. they just taking that further and further. And also I want to give a shout out now to these guys. They are going to Hacker Congress camp right now around Berlin and demoing some of the stuff. I mean, when this episode is coming out, it's probably already over, but they are demoing the stuff live there for the CCC camp.
Interesting. Shout out to you guys. Thanks for working on it. When is that over?
It's over before the end of August, like 25th or so.
This will be out before then.
Okay.
We can speed it up. Wait, no, 21st is like 2 days. So this will be out next week.
25th.
Oh, 25th. It'll be a few days after.
Yeah, I'm very proud. They took, I built a Lightning vending machine, which is like just a wooden box with some something that can spit something out, basically. And it was like, probably the coolest project that I've built with Lightning. They're taking that with them and demoing that there. So.
That's
gonna thank them.
It's fucking huge. Congrats, man. People building on your work. How's that feel?
It's great. Yeah. I was very proud that they I wasn't at home anymore, but they picked it up and taking it with them. I didn't have to beg them for it. They really wanted to take it with them and show it off. There's also guys there that have built awesome stuff like e-bike that you can rent with Lightning and e-scooter that you can rent with Lightning.
The original Slockic dream.
Yeah, basically. Yeah, it's really that. Yeah, it's awesome.
Oh yeah, and this is what a lot of people were saying back during the Slockit and ICO boom was just wait, like Bitcoin's going to enable these use cases on different layers and microtransactions are able to enable stuff like renting a scooter and stuff like that now. It just took some time. Like what excites you most about Lightning from a use case perspective? Like streaming transactions, microtransactions, just the ability to transact a little bit more privately and for less fees. What in particular excites you?
I've thought about it quite a bit, and that was the reason also why I built a vending machine was really that I like that use case in particular as something that is very easily comes to mind when you think of what you pay for with money, but it was just not possible with Bitcoin on-chain before. Even if you are at Room 77 and you want to pay, you have some time, and mostly they trust the people that they know, but
they're gonna go zero com for you.
If they know you, they will do that, but. You can wait like 10, 20 minutes, after one, two confirmations, unless you've drunk the whole bar, they will definitely let you go, and you can do that. That's still practical. But like a vending machine, if you're running to the train, and I'm doing that a lot, you want to just grab a can of Coke or whatever on the way, like it needs to go quickly. Or if you're at the checkout, there's a line behind you. Every second counts, and so I wanted to just build something that builds on that use case. So that's why I've actually built a vending machine. Several things of streaming money and so on. I've thought about them a lot, but I don't think they're super practical. So there's a paper by Nick Szabo that's come out a long time ago. I don't know, 2011, 2012, on the mental load.
The mental cost.
Yeah, mental cost of paying for video streaming, for example, by the second. Mm-hmm. And I'm a huge believer in that. Like it's even if you would enable that, I just don't see it being used in the wild that much. Like you have Netflix and people are, even if they don't use it for a month or for 3 months, like they are happy to just pay one fixed fee and not have to think about it again when they turn it on. But then if you watch a shitty movie am I going to watch finishing it and it's going to cost me 15 cents or do I turn it off now? It's just not a situation that people want to be in.
No, I agree. That's
That's a very good point. Like, too many mental costs is a bad user experience at the end of the day, right?
Yeah. Mental accounting.
Yes. Yeah. Mental accounting. Yeah. No, and that's like what blows my mind about like the ERC-20 world, like especially like with like MakerDAO and DAI and like all these obscure DeFi projects, like the mental cost of going into thinking about everything you need to take into consideration with these projects in particular is like and that's my favorite thing to do when thinking about the future of Bitcoin, the future of all this stuff is like we are in our bubble where we meet and speak with mainly people who are interested in Bitcoin, and that's where we spend a lot of our time and a lot of our focus, and this is very apparent, like obviously not like a hidden secret to anybody. We're in a bubble, like we're very interested in this niche technology. And so like when I'm on the street, and like that's, I like to have a lot of walking conversations with Bitcoiners and use it when, particularly when the topic of usability comes up, I'm like, look at all these people on the street. Do you think they're like, if they know about Bitcoin, it's just because they've heard about it on the news. And like, do you think like all these people are going to, and picking on DeFi in particular, like adopt DeFi and start using Ethereum as collateral for DAI with other assets they can add to it, but they also have to think of the price of Ethereum at any given point in time and whether their loans collateralize enough or not. Like, no, that's too many mental accounting decisions that come into individuals' everyday lives.
Yeah, I mean, like, you can also make the argument that there are going to be layers built on top of that as well, just like are going to be with Bitcoin. I mean, all of these people are probably also not going to choose their own fees and stuff like that. I looked at this for quite a while and just didn't really see use cases that made sense to me. And I mean, let's say WikiLeaks or so. Yeah, that could be a DApp. Okay, I understand that. You know? But there's just not that many WikiLeaks. There's just not that many people that have or companies or whatever that have really a use case that requires a decentralized application.
The SAT node's proving to be a good WikiLeaks if you wanted to do it too, right? Have you been following the Blockstream satellite? Like you can send messages from Lightning?
Yeah.
should we send a message right now? Like this is like the new wiki. Like you don't even need, let me find it. You don't even need like a dApp to do this. You can just use Bitcoin, the Lightning Network in particular. I got the signal my beep down here. This is when you do demos live, you don't have Wi-Fi. All right, let me find this. What is it? Come on. Let's see a lot of. There it is, LNTX bot. So, app satellite 50. Have you never seen this?
No.
App, I am for you freaks at home. I am using the SAT node. What should our message say? So I'm using this Telegram bot to make an app call to the satellite. I'm gonna pay 50 satoshis. And now our message, what should we say? Hey, from TFTC with Fabian.
Yeah. To CCC camp.
What was that?
To CCC camp.
What is your handle at what?
FJAHR.
To
CCC, capital C's, camp.
All right. So boom, sent.
Nice.
Live demos, boom, sent. Then we'll go over to Twitter. We'll see if it picked it up yet. So this is, so for you freaks at home that are just listening to me, demo this to Fabian, we're sending a message to the SAT node. You'll be able to find this in retrospect. Maybe you're seeing it right now.
And yeah, boom. I see it.
But it's not, I mean, we know that I sent it, but like the idea is that you don't know who sent it. And it's just a random message sent to the satellite.
Nice.
Yeah. So that's like a decentralized WikiLeaks. You don't even need DApp for that, right? You just need Telegram and the Lightning Network and the satellite.
Yeah.
Which is crazy. Like, this is again, like we were touching on in the beginning of the episode, like I don't feel like people grasp the gravity of this technology. Like it's yeah. a pretty big change in the way that people are going to view money and then actually like freedom in the digital age.
Yeah.
Do you realize that? Is somebody building on this?
I mean, I feel like everyone who's building something on it is kind of building on that, right? But it's, you still have to remind yourself every time you think about it that's how big it is. Yeah. It's crazy.
I feel very honored to be here speaking with you. A kindred spirit as well, working on Bitcoin. We're an hour and a half in here now. To end it on Lightning, like where do you see it going? Do you see it improving drastically and getting to the point where people can go to vending machines and make fast and easy payments? Because sometimes they'll go to make a Lightning transaction, it'll take a little bit to find a route, and the payment will take like 10 to 30 seconds. Like, do you think that gets cut down to almost instantaneous over time?
Yeah, I don't see that like happening drastically, but I think it's like short term, you know, you overestimate, but then long term you underestimate. So it's going to be the matter of not weeks or months, I think, until it's like very, very user friendly. But in I would say few years, I definitely see it going to something that we can just use like credit card payment or so with the same ease and
bang bang. It's been an incredible conversation. Thank you for coming by again on this Monday night.
Thank you for having me.
Well,
it's really awesome.
Yeah. Again, any last comments you want to make? Any words of advice to somebody maybe approaching Bitcoin Core or approaching Bitcoin development, or who may be on the fringe, not knowing where to jump in from a developer's perspective?
I mean, first of all, if you're listening to this maybe a year from now or 9 months from now, and you're thinking about applying to another residency or so, just go ahead. Don't think about it too much. Just, you know, answer the questions and. I don't know if there's a coding challenge or not, but yeah, just definitely do it. I think every one of the participants was like feeling like they didn't belong for whatever reason, or so like
a lot of imposter syndrome.
Yeah. So really, don't worry about that too much. In the meantime, if you just want to jump in, just look around for the resources. Don't be afraid to approach people on IRC if you have questions about anything. Like, people are much more approachable than you might think. Like, I'm still amazed by that. I definitely don't even use it enough right now. I mean, like right now I have face-to-face access to people directly, but the channels are basically open to lots of people. Just jump in, just look around on GitHub or whatever for some kind of small open issue or something that you observe that could be improved by just a little bit, and just get started.
Yeah, I think that's great advice. Don't be afraid. I imposter syndrome is something to be overcome, and you'll find that a lot of people are nicer than you expect out there.
Exactly.
Fabian, it's been a pleasure. I wish you well in the last 11 days of the residency. Looking forward to seeing what you put out there and what you continue to build. And thank you for contributing to Bitcoin. Seriously, we need more people like you. It's a very important project. I believe imperative for the future of humanity. So thank you again for working on it, trying to make it better.
Thank you. Peace. And thank you for talking about it a lot and promoting it.
Well, again, I wouldn't have anything to talk about if there weren't people like you building it. So with that, I bear you farewell, freaks. Peace and love.
Okay.